Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome back to the Front Three. On today's show, there's plenty to come up. We've seen all the weekend's football. And to join me, two guys from across the Atlantic. Nico Morales, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Which local shopping centre are you in?
Me? I am in no local shopping centre. I think that is the other fantastic person that we have on the podcast, Kristen Hennage.
Chris, whereabouts in New York? You're in Manhattan?
Yes, that's correct.
And which shopping centre are you in?
One of the many.
And what's the weather like?
Dark.
That glaucoma's going well. Anyway, let's go down the Premier League. And the best place to start does seem to be the big clash of the weekend. It was the late kickoff on Saturday, and it was actually a really entertaining game, Nico. Spurs, I mean, a lot of people, me included, predicted that it would be much closer than it was, and I think it was naive maybe to say that looking back, because actually this was a combination where Spurs looked off it from the very beginning, and that City team, as soon as they did score, realized there was a lot more for the taking here.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I think the scoreline is a little bit generous towards Manchester City and
really
how they
why?
Played. Not that they played poorly. I just think, you know, given, obviously I expressed how I feel Manchester City should be attacked, and it's been relatively successful in previous games this season, and obviously that wasn't the case for Tottenham. But I think this is a game, and Chris, I think, wrote something on Ederson as well, or was much more in-depth than I ever was, but this is a game I think where we can point to maybe down the line, and it's another moment in Guardiola's career where I think he's taken an element of the game, how the game is played, and looked at it a little bit differently, or had a player that could perform in a way that's a little bit different. And it's an interesting juxtaposition between, because obviously the news and sort of the media and fans, the fans that we interact with, have been really having a conversation about goalkeepers the past couple of weeks and the value of goalkeepers. And I think this is a game where Ederson pretty much won the game. He should be man of the match in and of himself because of the performance he had, because of the effect that he had on the game, because Spurs high pressing was, in my opinion, the right move. And I think they did as much as they could, but as I highlighted on Twitter, and I think a bunch of other people have as well through some elements of video, when you have a goalkeeper that can deliver a pass not only that accurately but that quickly to another player, you're performing an action, like a maybe 20, 30-yard passing action, exceptionally quickly. And when you have a team that's squeezing up the pitch and trying to make things exceptionally difficult for a team that has the ability to play out, that's not really a situation that you're going to encounter very often. And I think, you know, I watched the Chelsea-Southampton game as well, and they really pressed Chelsea because they understand that Thibaut Courtois isn't super proficient with his feet. He's not bad with his feet, but he's not a player that has a great deal of experience doing that. And I think there are elements of the modern game where a bunch of teams can say, hey, look, if your goalkeeper isn't amazing with his feet, then we can squeeze the pitch. We can make it difficult for a team of a better quality, of a better ball-playing quality, to impose themselves on the game. Because if they never never get the chance to get going, if they never get the chance to start their attack, then I think that's really the best way to do it. But with someone like Ederson, who is able to pick out such precise passes so quickly and so consistently, that's like a game-breaking thing, because you can't press the goalkeeper when it's off a goal kick or in a situational, in a high-pressing sort of situational type of deal. And there's no answer to that, because, like I said, you can't press the goalkeeper. So I was really impressed with that, and I honestly, like I said, I wrote the preview for sort of in favor of Spurs, and I didn't think they were necessarily going to win, but I think they were the team to best challenge them. And given the fact that Manchester City obviously have this tool now, that Ederson is such a special part of this team.
I think he's a little more respectful than that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, given the fact that they have that ability, it's going to be difficult to see what teams do against this Manchester City team, because as Dave alluded to, there have been a number of teams who have tried to sit deep and be compact and frustrate Manchester City in that way. And while it's been close, it hasn't worked. And then, you know, more people have been saying, you know, this is the way to go. Try to make Manchester City do what they don't want to do, which is play out of certain situations and isolate certain players. And I maintain that there's more things that they could have done by isolating maybe Mangala and some other weaker passers. But when you have a goalkeeper that's able to put in that type of performance with, you know, passing distribution, it's very difficult to see past it what, you know, the possibilities are for this Manchester City.
Of course, it's obviously also about then you can intercept those passes. You can have people who are willing to battle for those. And I understand that can't be covered all over the pitch. And maybe if even one of them connects, that's a good thing. But it didn't seem, Chris, like Spurs had the game plan. And maybe, you know, maybe because it's difficult to get a game plan together, but it didn't seem like they had the game plan to be able to even challenge Man City in this game, let alone compete.
No, and I think part of that is because they were really stuck between a rock and a hard place, because when they tried to press, as Nico explained there quite articulately, Ederson played through the press. When they sat deep, they were cut open. I think what you're seeing realistically, it's funny that Guardiola called them the Harry Kane team. I think it's more now fitting to call them the Toby Alderweireld team, because he is very important to how they play football. And I think while a team like Man City or maybe even Man United has a bit more depth and can stretch itself, I think Tottenham at this precise moment, they really do have to start building the back end of the ship, because when they miss one of their starters like Alderweireld, like Kane, you could argue, it really has a much more sizable impact on them than I think, say, City or United feel. And yes, maybe part of that is down to tactics as well, but I think there is a something to be said for the lack of depth that Spurs are having to work with at this precise moment.
Yeah, it certainly does open up a bit of a gap at the top of the Premier League. Manchester United obviously also getting their victory in there. Romelu Lukaku being part of that. And of course, you can head over to Statman Dave's channel to go see all the latest on that. I don't want to take away from what Stave is doing over there. Some excellent work and excellent analysis of Manchester United and all the tactics and everything that went on over the weekend. Well worth a look. Elsewhere in the league, though, Nico, it was a satisfying, if sort of maybe not casual, but you know, a performance that Liverpool fans maybe have come to expect from the guys at Liverpool. And they just pretty much outplayed Bournemouth in every era of the park. But I guess the caveat for me is, I know there's this great run and Liverpool have got, you know, so many clean sheets in so many games and are actually rivaling Manchester United in terms of a defensive record, I think over the last 16 games. But Bournemouth didn't do themselves any favours. But I guess that's kind of what Klopp bets on, isn't it? When he plays this sort of pressing football and high pressure, take them high up the pitch, you sort of bet that the opposition are going to struggle and that they are going to panic.
To some extent, I think that's true. But I think what we're seeing right now is, and I'm curious to sort of get your opinion on this, is really an evolution that I think is necessary for Liverpool Football Club with the way that they approach teams. Because obviously when Jurgen Klopp came in, I think that the general sort of narrative surrounding the Liverpool situation was, especially under Jurgen Klopp, was that they were very proficient against some of the better teams. They could be compact, they could be aggressive, pressing when they needed to be, but they were very secure. And so they won maybe a lot of the surprise games against the top six and teams that they really could take a scalp from, but they struggled against some of the lower league teams because of the way that they played. And I think the evolution is coming from a change in Klopp's tactics, but it's something that it might be affecting those results against the top six as well, because as I mentioned on the podcast, you know, the way that he creates space, the way that he creates transition in these kind of games is that obviously you can't force a team to open themselves up. But if you trick them into doing that, then you can create transition. And a team that has better players in transition like Liverpool do, a team that has players like Mohamed Salah and Philippe Coutinho and Sadio Mane are going to thrive in those situations. And when they open up the space between their midfield and their defense, and teams see that as a weakness, and it's something that the majority of the time Liverpool can capitalize on by you know, compressing really quickly and then winning the ball back and then going forward, I think this is where Liverpool are starting to put more and more and more points together because of how they've changed that. Now, as a strategy against teams that are going to expose that and maybe exploit that sort of presented weakness a little bit quicker than a Bournemouth or something like that, I think that's where maybe the approach needs to be a little bit more tailored for Liverpool. But if Liverpool want to consistently, which they haven't been for a while, but are starting to be, but if Liverpool want to consistently be part of the top four, I think this is the this is exactly the strategy that they need to enact. And I think given all that we've said and all that I've specifically said about Jurgen Klopp, I think this is the right direction for Liverpool. And it's going, we've talked about criticisms and all that, but I at the end of the day, I think this is where he wanted to go and intended to go.
Yeah. I mean, Chris, part of it is, and I think Mohamed Salah is maybe a good example of it. The example of people knowing the potential of Salah, people seeing the potential of Salah, and at times accusing Klopp of being a little bit of a crude manager in the way that he uses players. But you can pick out pretty much, I'd say, any of that front line, actually, that played on the weekend, and see where there's an element of Klopp that's improved them. Salah, it almost seems a little obvious in the goal scoring. I think he's also changed his... changed in the way that it doesn't seem as if they're quite, not expansive, but he's not quite as up and down in this, or as open maybe as Roma were when he played for Roma. I think he's definitely almost a bit more of a complete final third player now than he was for Roma, when some of his decision making was maybe questionable at times. Coutinho has pushed deeper, but then has also been able to come forward and combine with a slightly improved, if maybe less prolific looking Firmino, and then you know you got whoever else in there, Adam Lallana, who's also coming back from an injury. It might look crude maybe in analysis, but there's a lot of work behind the scenes that I think makes that Liverpool team feel to some extent unstoppable when they're in their stride.
I think there's two elements that stick out to me. I think the first one is the motivational aspect of Klopp, which has been detailed in numerous pieces before. I think the other thing is they seem a bit more efficient as an attacking line. They don't seem to me...
I think it's something like 45 goals, or maybe it might even be 50 goals amongst the front four of Liverpool that under Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah, and I think it doesn't just present itself in the goal tally. I think you look at the way they produce goals as well, the build-ups. There's very rarely a wasted pass or something that feels as if someone's been stifled. It all clicks into place very seamlessly. And I think that is partly down to him and the way that he orchestrates his attacking teams. Now, I think what helped them slightly against Bournemouth, and look, if Mane passes against Everton, we're talking about this is a fabulous run of results. I think what really helped them with Bournemouth is Bournemouth were very disjointed. I think they played with a back three at some point, and the space between them was frightening. And I think at the same time, that doesn't take away anything from what Salah and those around him were doing. I just think that Bournemouth and Eddie Howe were both very naive in the way they approached this game. And I think that's the problem, is that perhaps in the past you could get away with being a little bit naive against a Liverpool side, probably pre-Klopp, A little bit less so with Rodgers when you had Suarez there, but you could sort of just pack in deep and not have too much to worry about. But I think this team is a lot smarter in the way it attacks, and it's easy to reduce it to you know, counter-attacking or whatever. But I think there is more to it than that. I think there's an efficiency to the way they produce moves and the way they build attacks. And now they have the individual quality that I think supplements the group as a whole. But when it recalls for a moment like Salah's goal, where he just very much picks up the ball and does it all himself, they have that potential in them now that I didn't see maybe, a year or two ago.
Yeah, some people accuse me of being a little less maybe positive about Liverpool, but I mean, I guess there's more progress to be made. Although, there is also progress being made in that I think Klopp it should be moving towards that final stage of getting the players in that he wants and getting the final few players who maybe he's had to use in the interim it is very long interim now, such as Daniel Sturridge, etc., to a certain point. Let's see if that continues. Daniel Sturridge, sadly, despite being somewhat of a Liverpool legend now through taking Liverpool so close to the title and playing alongside so many great players, maybe spanning between the post Benitez era, if you like, when it was the most exciting team Liverpool have fielded in quite some time. Sadly, it might be on his way in January because he will want to find himself on the plane with England come the World Cup and the visit to Russia. So let's see if he can get down to that. Nico, any thoughts on the Chelsea game over the weekend? Because obviously, there's actually quite a lot of politics going on at Chelsea. I think very rarely, though, do we cover what's actually going on the pitch. And the only thing that separated them from Southampton was one goal from Marcus Alonso. And Statman Dave said it to me beforehand. He knew that they were going to be a threat. But do you think they're posing enough of a threat without Morata up front and Hazard? Is that combination, or is Hazard doing enough as that false nine-ish kind of leading the line but allowing others to come in?
I think in terms of analyzing Hazard, I think this is the best I've seen him play in quite a while, because I've been really impressed with his performances, like off the ball specifically. I think that's, if anyone has a criticism of Hazard over the past couple of years, it's his inability sometimes to affect a game when he's been marked out of it. And obviously that came to fruition against Manchester United when he was specifically marked out of the game and he couldn't do much at all. But he's done more this season to be more of a threat off the ball to influence the opposition's back line. But in terms of talking about the Southampton game in specific, you just have to feel for that club, because they, I think, given the fact that they're what, like 12th or 14th or something in the table, they're an incredibly gifted group of players. And I think a couple of years from now, when some of those guys have moved on to bigger and better things, no disrespect to Southampton, but when some of those guys have moved on, we'll probably look at that Southampton team and say, wow, they were all on the same team at the same time, and they didn't do very much more than achieving a League Cup final against Manchester United, which they undeservedly lost. But it's interesting. They enacted, a perfect plan to sort of try to go for Chelsea, because it's a microcosm of sort of the Spurs and Manchester City game. I think if you tried in the modern era, if you try to sit back against these teams that can open you up six different ways across, then that's just a recipe for sort of taking your defeat laying down. You might as well try to compact the space, try to high press, and it almost worked against Chelsea. There was a few good opportunities for Southampton in the first half, like I said, given Courtois' inability with his feet. But, they were able to create enough. Chelsea were able to create enough opportunities for themselves to finish, and they've made their buck over the past year on some incredible finishing, especially from Marcus Alonso, from free kicks and from crazy shots and stuff like that. So I feel for Southampton, but I really kind of like where this Chelsea team is going in terms of like Champions League ability.
Chris, I guess as a journalist yourself, you're going to hear quite a lot about, and also as a football scout, I think you're going to hear quite a lot about transfers. I guess something I'm kind of sick of reading as a Liverpool follower and fan is Liverpool are still pursuing Virgil van Dijk, but then there are people who are getting annoyed or maybe want to shut down the talk about Coutinho leaving. And Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain did a very nice thing on the weekend where He sort of stepped in when Coutinho was slightly embarrassed by the situation, couldn't quite, bat away the question of, are you going to be here until the end of the season? A perfectly sort of legitimate question, some people would say, but one that maybe some Liverpool fans believe that was out there purely to destabilize or to take away from what was a nice performance from him. Do you think there's an element of double standards there at Liverpool at the moment? Because I certainly feel there is, and I feel very close to the club, but feel like they're now just paving the way and trying to smooth the transition away, not only for Coutinho, but also for themselves. And I don't know, there's something that I don't like about it as a fan.
I think that's a good question. I think ultimately what a football club in their position has to do is almost hedge its bets. I think they're self-aware enough to know that there's a chance Barcelona come in with another renewed bid. And I think you have to also be conscious, not just of what the player may want, but how you will appear during that scenario. So if you make some impassioned stance and say, we won't be selling him for any price, that paints you into a corner. And I think Liverpool know that if they were to receive a bid that in the region of what was rumoured, that 130 million mark, they'd have to seriously consider it, because they could invest that in a player that could arguably replicate or even have a greater influence on the team, not necessarily an attacker, perhaps a centre-back, perhaps a goalkeeper, whichever position Klopp deems most important. And I think for that reason, Liverpool are not encouraging the sale of Coutinho, but I do think they're not ruling it out. And I think that's the difficult thing for fans to take sometimes, is that your football club does think a little bit like a business in that sense, in that players can quickly become asset management. And that's perhaps not romantic enough for football fans, or not what they want to hear. But I think you have to look at it from that pragmatic standpoint. And ultimately, I think that's what Liverpool are doing. And you know, more power to them in that sense.
Slightly frustrating, but I guess at the same time, let's see what happens. We'll be interested to see where Liverpool take this and how far they manage to take the Liverpool faithful. Maybe Naby Keita next summer, when Coutinho is on his way out, will help to placate that a little. But let's see. We'll see. Anything else you guys want to cover before we go international on this one? No, great.
I think there was...
Was there anything else?
I'd be curious to hear Chris's words on.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. We should have spoken about Newcastle. Yeah, Newcastle are definitely an interesting team, Chris, in the Premier League at the moment. I mean, it feels as if there are the almost ifs every week. I know that being beaten 3-1 or 4-1 or whatever is the way it goes, but there's that glint of hope every week. And this weekend, it was only losing 1-0 to Arsenal. It seems, and I don't know if this is true, maybe you can update me on this, as if Rafa's doing everything in his power to keep Newcastle in a decent position. But is it enough, I guess, in the long term? And is it really just now waiting for a takeover?
I think it is waiting for a takeover, or at least confirmation that there'll be a set figure to spend in January, because Amanda Stavely could agree a deal in principle and then say, okay, the club will subsequently invest X in January, and that will be added or deducted from the final price. I'm not entirely sure on the specifics, but I know it's possible, because Man City did it prior to their changeover from Taksin Shinawat to the current ownership. In terms of Benitez, I think he's used an analogy before about a short blanket. In that it will sometimes cover your feet, but leave your chest exposed, vice versa. And I think that's the predicament he's in at the minute. And that's not to absolve him of blame. I think there are some decisions that I don't necessarily agree with. I'd like to see Alexander Mitrovic more involved, for example. I'd prefer to see Chancellor Mbemba instead of Javi Manquillo. But I do think at this point, he's whenever he's picking plays, it tends to be the subs that change the game. Matt Ritchie, I thought, was a much better involved. I think Jacob Murphy is having a really good sort of upturn in form, and unfortunately amid what is pretty dire form for the rest of the team. But I think for him, he's trying to get to January and just strengthen, because it's not for lack of effort, I think, that Newcastle are losing. I think it is. It's just that moment of quality. And I look at someone like Palace, who, you know, all this great stuff is being written about Hodgson and what he's doing. I think you look at that squad and you've got Zaha, who's worth anywhere between 35 to 50 million, depending on what you read. Benteke, who cost over 25. Townsend, who cost over 10, is an England international. Loftus-Cheek, who, credit to Palace, they did really well to get him on loan because he has broken out this season. Kabay, who's a French international. That's a good nucleus of a squad that fits the manager perfectly. And I think you could argue that's probably a more damning indictment of Mike Ashley in Newcastle, that their manager's been in place for, what is it, 18 months now, maybe a little bit longer. And he still hasn't been granted, I would argue, the correct tools to build a Premier League squad. That's the key difference. He's 15 million in the black, if you look at his entire tenure in terms of what he's spent and sold. And he's the only manager, I think, of the sums I did the other day, that's in the black in that bottom half. The rest are in the red one way or another. And so I find it a little bit confusing when his detractors say, well, you know, he's wasted money on Diame and Manquillo and Hosolu. I'd love to see who these people would be buying with that kind of money, because it is real chicken scratch in today's market. And that's the difficulty, is that 5-10 million, yes, you know, 24 months ago, that maybe gets you a decent player. But Benitez has said himself, it really doesn't. You know, it's. I think he said something like, it's 10 million for a striker that can kick forward, 15 for one that can kick forward and backward. It's very much in that wheelhouse that prices have shot up, and Newcastle haven't caught up with that in relation to their own budgets and standards.
Yeah, certainly it does make it tricky, but at the same time, it must be a very exciting time as a Newcastle fan. I mean, there is that anticipation of a takeover. I guess the only issue is that it's been mooted before, hasn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the difficulty, is that any excitement of the possible takeover is almost dimmed slightly by the current predicament, because it would be just like Newcastle to get a new owner in, maybe spend a bit in January and still, you know, go down on the last day of the season. The good thing is Benitez had, what was it, 2 months and managed to fall last time by the skin of his teeth. He's got potentially five or six months now with some, I would say, winnable games at home. Jamal Lascelles back in the team, which I don't think can be understated. He really is a huge unifier for that team and someone that holds a lot of the team together. And so, yeah, there's positives there if you look hard enough. I think the frustration for fans stems from the fact that this is so much more difficult than it needed to be. And that's the problem with Mike Ashley. He's willing to take that gamble and you know, risk the fact that they could finish 17th or they could finish 18th, which is what they did a few years ago when Sunderland stayed up at Newcastle's expense. And that's the problem, is speaking as a fan for a second, we feel as if we don't need to take that risk anymore. We realise what taking that risk does. It sees you playing Burton away from home, you know, a few months later. And that's the frustration, is it feels that lessons aren't learned.
Yeah, that frustration, I guess, yeah, that frustration may not last forever, though. And think of it this way, Chris. Soon you could be signing Robinho. Or the equivalent.
That would be nice.
You know what I mean? The equivalent of when Shinawatra got taken out of Man City, and after paying that time, they got their Robinho. The rest is history. He didn't win the league with them. But they did put down a good marker, and that's all that mattered. And now look at where City are.
Did either of you read Angel Rangel's interview in the Independent?
Not read it yet.
I read some of it. I think it's quite good.
What leapt out to you?
I think his honesty, first and foremost, because it's very easy in that predicament when you're, I think you can class him as a club stalwart at this stage in his career, to be someone that doubles down and you know, protects the ranks and all this. But I think, I thought he was very illuminating, very willing to call a spade a spade. Obviously, he's very settled in Swansea and the club means a lot to him. And I think that comes across in what he says and how he says it. And the fact that he was kind of willing to admit that the Swansea way had sort of disappeared from the club in recent years, I think it highlighted something that maybe some of us had thought but not been able to connect together with the dots. And it is a shame, because Swansea were one of the better run clubs, whereas in recent years I think they've lost that stability and structure, and that's what puts them in the predicament that they're in now.
I have a question for the both of you, just sort of in that realm of questioning, I guess, with the Angel Rangel piece, which is something that I think everybody should go and read. It's like Chris said, it's illuminating. But I think I haven't read all of it yet, but when I did stop reading it and then sort of came away with it and I was kind of thinking it over, I had just recently read something about sort of the different analytical rankings of different Premier League teams and sort of their underlying numbers. And it sort of popped out to me about, especially this season, with, you know, expected goals being the most mainstream now, deep metric that people use, and it not really having a home yet and people not necessarily understanding it or how to use it. And sort of, I was thinking, you know, basically the final thought there was it doesn't really have a home or specific usage yet. I think in really the mainstream, it's kind of struggling to find that. And the analytics rankings that I read were talking about Newcastle and how they've suffered really from some bad luck in terms of their results. And I think the person who wrote it, which I think was Mike Goodman, was talking about, you know, his fanship as an Everton supporter in seasons past. Talked about sort of the outside effects that can start to weigh on a club in terms of when they have like a bad run of results. And, you know, even if things aren't as bad as the results lead on, the negative coverage in the media, the negative coverage in the press, and sort of the aura around a club can very much be dictated by the people that cover it and the fans' reaction to that coverage and all those sorts of things. And I wonder.
I think that can be open to who the manager is or these kind of things, because you also get managers who almost completely shut themselves away. I mean, you can see the difference in. I was listening to the Rambles 12 Days of Christmas, and they were talking about one Christmas Leicester City were bottom of the Premier League, next season they were top of the Premier League, and a huge part of that I think is the approach, and you know it's amazing what a short space of time changed.
And I guess my question to you two would be, because of sort of the subjective nature of how things are covered and maybe how fans react to that, and now maybe there's a more mainstream acceptance of these deeper metrics, I'm not going to disagree with what Chris said about Newcastle, but the underlying numbers for that team leads us to believe that these results will not continue and they've suffered a little bit more than they should have. Do you think, given the more mainstream acceptance of numbers that can lead us to different conclusions than the results, will maybe one day start to change how those factors, how those what people call soft factors, affect the aura around a club and how fans think, and maybe it stops, you know, a bad performance or it changes a result because of how people accept, you know, the performance of their team as opposed to the result?
It certainly is an interesting one, Chris, isn't it? I mean, Newcastle are probably a prime example of this, aren't they?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yep, I think looking at some of their results, there's only one game where I think really they've been totally outclassed, and that was against Manchester United. And I think you look at the Arsenal game, again, they kept it tight. The Everton game, for my money, if Darlow doesn't drop that ball, it stays 0-0 at worst. There was a chance Everton had in the second half from Ashley Williams that was well saved by Darlow. But that spillage, which again, it's a mistake and you don't want to lump it on the player, but I'm sure there's part of Benitez is sitting there saying, you know what, I told you in the summer we needed a new goalkeeper. He tried to shift Darlow out to Middlesbrough for $5 million. So a lot of what he said in the summer has been vindicated over these months, and I certainly don't think he's throwing games by any stretch. But I imagine there's a sense of frustration for him that what he informed the club is now coming to pass. I think they've been a shade unlucky. There's definitely been some games. I mean, the Bournemouth game at home, they went 1-0 up, and it was ruled out for offside, and there was not a chance in hell it was offside, which, again, you look at that, Bournemouth end up getting the 1-0 win. That takes the pressure off them a bit, keeps the pressure further on Newcastle. And I'm always reminded of Allardyce saying that these things do not even themselves out. And it's a concern because these decisions, these results, they mount up. And you know, there's a hope that eventually luck will come to pass, because you look at just silly things like the last time Newcastle played with a man advantage in the Premier League. It was 2014. They haven't had a man sent off against them since 2014.
And I do, I see what you're saying. I see the same for Arsenal, right? I mean, you know, the mentality at the club, the coverage, definitely, especially, I think it's also how outward looking the fans are and how much they care about what other fans think as well, right? Or how they deal with that at times, because Arsenal's a classic club, and this, again, maybe you can make this argument about Arsenal fans TV, almost makes them more outward looking because they suddenly care about their image.
I think that's the frustration for Newcastle fans at this point is, you know, there's almost a confusion as to why they're not on Rafa Benitez's back. And yet, when they have been on Benitez's back, like Alan Pardew, who was in genuinely dire form and the team were playing poorly and they were soundly and rightly being beaten, they were told that they shouldn't hound a manager out and that the club needs stability. And
well, I think that's the good thing is that, I mean, Chris, they're having a good football man out of the club.
Well, that's the thing. I think they almost feel damned if they do, damned if they don't. And this is where we have to be careful about lecturing football fans. Because, yeah, I do. I think they've certainly had some bad luck. I can think of a few. I mean, there was the Huddersfield game early in the season where there was an almost identical tackle to the one that Edison and Mane got involved in that wasn't given as a red card. In fact, I don't even think it was given a yellow card at the time. And you look at, you know, an instance like that, you look at Harry Kane's tackle on the first day that could have been a red card. As I said, the goal against Bournemouth. And it does. I think it certainly breeds a victim complex in clubs and fans. And that's where, you know, it starts to feel like, well, it doesn't really matter how we play because the decisions aren't going for us. And then we get mired in the intangibles of, you know, well, I mean, I said that Sam Allardyce was incredibly lucky last week against Newcastle, and he was. And a lot of the people who are big fans of Sam Allardyce said, well, you know, they work hard, so they get lucky. That's so unquantifiable that it makes it a moot point because you can't really prove one way or the other whether that's true.
Not yet, anyway. I mean, you know, it's also whether the fans feel like there's hard work or not, and whether they see the right kind of hard work, I guess, for those fans. Nick, I'll give you the final word because you were going to talk about one thing on that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think Arsenal is it's interesting because this is a new age of information. And I don't think people, specifically pundits, kind of pay enough respect to that remark because you talked about Arsenal and I agree. The coverage of Arsenal has been incredibly tired over the past couple of years because it's pretty much the same thing that's said about them every season. And I think Arsenal fans very much buy into that. And I think the laziness and this comes from me as well, because I could do more to maybe dispel that. But I think, like I said, it's a new age of information. And I think right now, considering where the club is going, where Arsenal is going, it's really the first club in the modern era, in the social media era, in these, you know, this new access of all these types of information that we're seeing a major shift in power. And I think we have to understand and accept that with all this new information, the transition and like you mentioned, those fans deeply care about what other fans think of them. And 10, 15 years ago, that wasn't the case. Arsenal wasn't looked upon as how it is now. But given the fact that there are all these extra measures as to how we look at things, extra measures as how we can talk to and communicate and look at other fans, there are all these extra measures in there. And I think that's not something that maybe we look at well enough, and maybe we can't understand it right now because we're in the middle of it, and it's much easier to analyze something in hindsight. But I think it's something that we definitely need to acknowledge.
That's also a little bit of a cop out, I think, on most people's parts when they say it's difficult to analyze because we're in it. Sure.
All right. I'm sorry.
No. I'm not saying you're saying that. I do think there's a lot of people that sort of therefore take the debate, just sort of shut the debate down. Because they go, well, we're in it. Let's see what happens when we get out of it. And you're a bit like, yeah, but that's because you really want to just hide the effects of all the shit that you're doing. I'm not saying that's what you're saying. Chris Wong, very simple question from Elliot here. It says, should Mark Hughes be sacked?
Yes.
Great. Thank you, Chris. And then there's a great point made by Matt Brownie Cake here, who says, what happens to linesmen in these recent weeks, not seeing offsides, players, fouls, penalties, etc.? I'm not saying that ain't good, but maybe we need more so they are all fresh for the day's work. Like, good point, Matt. I think there was a point in the Liverpool game on the weekend where Firmino was offside. I think there have been a number of incidents in recent weeks where maybe the linesman hasn't been able to keep up with the play. Maybe it's the argument for the sixth man on the sidelines, maybe more, maybe less, or maybe more video refereeing. Someone who shouldn't be allowed near a camera for a while is Antoine Griezmann, Chris. He's done something ridiculously stupid to do, and the terrible thing would be to say he didn't mean it in a racist way and therefore it is not bad. And even therefore, because he didn't mean it in a racist way, it's funny, because it isn't. He tweeted a picture of himself blacked up as a Harlem Globetrotter, and then when was criticized for the tweet, then said words to the effect of, relax, it's a tribute. And it's hard to cover, because Nico and I were talking about this beforehand, and we were saying, Chris, you know, not everyone does know or understand the effects of these things. Ignorance isn't in any way a defense in this. It's almost hard to know how to cover it, because you don't want to be too damning of a man who clearly did not know those effects. What it maybe shows is a naivety with which maybe a lot of people in society are operating right now. And I imagine even in covering it, we're sort of buying into elements of that naivety.
Yeah, I think what's important to distinguish here is first and foremost is that, yeah, I think there's a naivety because from what I have been able to observe of Spanish culture, and to a certain degree Italian culture as well, the countries have very curious relationships of race. As we talked about, you and I, last night, the two fans, I believe the Spanish fans, who went to an F1 event and blacked up to look like Lewis Hamilton. There was the Spanish basketball team that did a slant eyes gesture ahead of, I believe it was the Olympics in Beijing. Those are, to me, are fairly prime examples of just the difficulty that these nations have in terms of understanding things. And that might sound very bizarre to us, you and I, speaking as Englishmen, and Nico as an American.
Yeah, it does seem like an almost typically English or sort of Western liberal outrage, which you can sort of understand because of what they're trying to champion. But at the same time, there's the other side, I guess, you're going to get onto.
And this is the thing, I think, we have to be very careful with the words we use, and that is what will stop it being damning, is you can be racist in the moment and not be inherently racist. That's the difference I think you need to really focus on here, is that the decision he made to do that it was naive, and it was racist at the moment of him doing it, because again, it was defining someone by the way that they're looking in what I would constitute a negative way, even if he saw it as a positive. I don't then believe in the same breath that he views black people, other minorities, other races, whatever, in a negative light, and as if they are below him because he's best friends with Paul Pogba and this kind of thing. And I appreciate that to a lot of people, that is often a racist defense, that some of my best friends are, insert, you know, whichever race they have offended. I don't think, though, that he is of that group. I think, if anything, he's made an ill-judged decision, likely informed by the culture that he's been present to. And I think this is one of those instances where, again, he hasn't meant it in a derogatory, negative way, so we can take this opportunity to educate and to help bring the conversation forward in a positive way. Because I think when you ostracize someone like this, that is when you potentially push them towards being racist. And that's the difference I think you need to really consider, is that you can do something that is racist and not be racist at the same time. That's a nuance that I think is sometimes lost when we try to define things, and I wish there was a better choice of words for it, but define things in very black and white, polarizing ways between
terrible choice
yes
of words.
Or no.
It's definitely true. Although then I guess, Chris, the point is that you can then be racist in reacting to it, which it seems there are many people out there who indeed have been racist in reacting to it. And also racist in defending the action, because you don't seem to understand why that might upset some people, even though you aren't
also
a terrible racist person, maybe in your own head.
I think also a thing that maybe we need to avoid here is assuming any sort of intention, because as Chris mentioned, we don't necessarily know Antoine Griezmann's intention. I think we would all like
I don't think he would have posted a massive smiling picture like that if he'd meant to upset.
No, yeah, and that's the thing. But I think the important thing here, especially with, you know, with some of the replies that we've received, given our, I think, generally cogent opinions between the four of us or between the five of us, on the matter is why something like blackface is something that's racist. It's because, you know, blackface was used as a device to perpetuate a society where black people and people of color are oppressed. And regardless of whether you live in a time where blackface has never been used in that context, regardless of whether, you know, you live in a society or you live in a situation where you're privileged enough to have never faced any sort of degradation due to race, religion, or creed, whatever, that doesn't mean that certain things don't hold a weight because of what they inherently have garnered throughout history. It's as if someone, and it's not exactly the same thing, but is, you know, if you take a symbol that has garnered a sense of bigoted views and hatred, then that image will always carry those things. And even if you intend to repurpose it, that's really not up to white cis males to do that. And I think the point here, and NPR did a really good section on something similar, which is like the word Jew, which in American language has garnered a derogatory connotation. And there was a Jewish journalist that they had on that talked about, and it's sort of similar to other sort of derogatory names and other things in specifically American culture. But he said it was sort of up to, you know, the people of the Jewish faith to reclaim that term and make it into something positive. And I think the responsibility, or not necessarily even the responsibility, but the action into how that evolves in our society is completely based on the actions of that group of people. And I think with something like blackface, it doesn't translate to a linguistic perspective. And I think given the fact that it has been used up until the 1980s on TVs in America to perpetuate or portray black people and people of color in a way that was not complimentary of their intelligence or anything good, then I think there is no qualms with saying that that is something that that is racist. The difficulty with that is that I think there are people on the other side of the equation that are, you know, they don't want to be said that they're a racist because they don't have an issue with it. They don't want to automatically be deemed something that they don't think that they are because they have a specific opinion on something. I think the key here is educating people as to why it has such a large significance in our society in terms of the race relations that is part of like what we need to do as I think people that are generally more informed. We need to educate people on why this is the way that it is and what meaning it has attached to it.
It's great coverage, at least from cis white male's perspective. Let us know what you guys think. We'd certainly be interested to progress the conversation in some way, considering how many minorities podcast might lack any minorities, and the conversation was had in a very serious way the other day whether Nico counts as a minority. Nico, you come to any good conclusions?
I can't derive anything, so we'll keep studying, we'll keep at it deciding whether I am or not.
Yep. That's very sweet. Let us know. Do you think Nico is a minority on the podcast? And don't say a minority of intelligence. That's not fair. Elsewhere, Real Madrid won against Gremio, crowning them World Club Cup champions. In other news that no one cares about, Star Wars is now out. Anyone on the podcast seen that?
I have.
Oh, yeah.
Not yet. All right. Spoilerless coverage, Nico. Does it involve football?
In no way, actually. I hadn't thought about that perspective, but in no way.
You would genuinely think that in the future, a game which was global, there's no sport in Star Wars. No sport.
They're the only sport in the new Star Wars, and this isn't really a spoiler, is like this Quidditch. Weird type of horse racing or dog racing. Some sort of racing of animals, but it's very similar to horse racing and dog
racing.
But
I guess there is a little bit of sport. There's that silly pod racing thing, but you know, there's no...
Gotta love pod racing. Come on now.
I guess being a Jedi is kind of a sport, maybe. I don't know. Maybe if the universe is balanced, you don't need... Maybe it's sort of a John Lennon style kind of, you know, everyone's... Imagine there's no heaven, blah, blah, blah. Or at the same time, maybe George Lucas just didn't like, as they call it in America, soccer. And therefore didn't write any bloody sport into Star Wars. It's just unusual. Do you know what I mean? You'd think like Han Solo would be like a space American football fan or something. You know, he'd like the Naboo cults. Do you know what I mean? Or something like that. The Senate. Pause.
The Endor Bay Packers.
there's one line every week, and then you're thinking, I don't know why they have Chris on the podcast, and then he says it, and you just go, there it is. Elsewhere, though, one of the forgotten Star Wars characters and angry bounty hunter, Gattuso, was left to a terrible loss, Nico, against Verona. He's put a Star Wars fatwa out on at least a few of his players. It was a pretty horrific loss. And having watched this one live, from about the point where they went 2-0 down, Milan just sort of knocked the ball around, not aimlessly, but when they then got near to goal, were just so profligate. It was really unusual to watch, but there was very little in terms of... A focus point in the side, and it seemed as if they were just a team that were coasting.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange given Milan are in an incredibly interesting situation because I think obviously they've been in not where they wanted to be in the past couple of years, and then last summer or a year ago, within the last year, they've received a major investment, and I think a lot of us viewed that as okay. AC Milan are on the way back up. We'll see them in the Champions League in a few years. And that was sort of the narrative that we bought. And now, yet again, I think given the insecurity, I think Chris pointed this out far before it ever happened, but you know, given the insecurity in their investment, given the insecurity from a managerial standpoint, I think it's a bit strange because it's a bit strange to have appointed Gattuso because none of the managerial stints that he has had has ended in success. And so it's almost as if they sent out a text to all of their former players that have coaching badges and said, does anyone want to take charge of the team while we look for someone? And they didn't have someone lined up in as a replacement for the coach that has been sacked. And it's just, you would think that a club that is so storied and even now has had multi-million dollar investment would have some sort of contingency plan as to when they went a different direction in terms of the manager. And it just seems like they gave him the job because he's an AC Milan legend. Obviously, we all liked him as a player, but as a manager, I don't think he stacks up nearly as well.
Yeah, it's certainly a different one, isn't it, Chris? I mean, this Milan team, I've got some very talented young players in there. It feels a little bit like he's just keeping a nest warm for someone else.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think when you have the approach that Gattuso does, which is very confrontational, very aggressive, you look at his spell at Crete. I think he was at Pisa where everything I had read was of similar description. I don't know if players respond well to that because they kind of look at it, at least I would if I was a player, I will ride this out. You know, he'll be gone 6 months, 8 months, whatever, and we'll be welcoming in a new manager. I think it's hard to inspire through that method specifically when you know that there's no longevity with the coach in question.
Yeah, certainly a frustrating one. But then, I guess elsewhere in Serie A, Nico, it's getting pretty exciting, I guess. I mean, look at the damn table. Let me try and bring this one up because actually I've been looking at it over the weekend, and Juventus now find themselves just 1 point off the top.
Juve to me are incredibly interesting.
Go on.
I think they're probably. I mean, obviously I've waxed lyrical about Napoli and everything that they've done, but. And they're still at the top of the table, and they've done well with the replacement to Fawzi Ghulam on the left-hand side to sort of replace that. I think, as I've said before, I don't necessarily blame Mauricio Sarri because a lot of people have come out and said, oh, you know, hit this bump in form and possibly the loss of a title because, you know, given Juventus' early season struggles, Napoli, since losing Ghulam, have not taken the opportunity to capitalize or had the opportunity to do so because their play has been significantly decreased because of the loss of such a major player to the first 11. And a lot of people have sort of come out and criticized Sadi for not rotating in the first place. And they believe that's what sort of led to the ACL injury. And I think that's a difficult criticism because the majority of the players that we're talking about in such a complimentary context with Napoli were really only that way under Sarri. He's made all of these players, or he's gotten the best out of these players in a major way. And I think Napoli lacked major financial investment. And I don't put a lot on him for not being able to find within the club's price range a left back that can fulfill the same duties. At the same time, I find Juventus incredibly fascinating because they've had their rough start. But I think Adam, a couple weeks ago, when he had the journalist on from Italian Football TV, spoke about some of the press conferences that Allegri has been referencing in terms of what he believes is the right approach in terms of his management. And he talked about his philosophy being split into the two halves of the season. And he thinks that it's more about the players understanding what he wants from them from a tactical perspective and how they need to play with each other in different systems in the first half of the season, really focusing more on the performances and then transitioning to the second half of the season, focusing more on the results. And I think that's what we're seeing with Juventus and why I have so little hope for Tottenham is because I think although we're seeing this year as a transitory period for the indomitable Juventus because of their loss of Bonucci, we're already seeing them pick up the pieces. They're only 1 point off the pace of Napoli, who were by far in a way ahead of the race at the beginning of the year. And despite maybe some lackluster performances in the early seasons of the Champions League, I think they're starting to pull that ship together. And this more attack-minded Juventus, which has scored the most goals in Serie A with 41, is starting to come to fruition, and the ability to transition from a player that's as good as Bonucci to slotting in Benatia and using the same system, but then using different systems, sort of in a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-4-2, is, I think it just speaks to Allegri's credit. And year after year, the more I watch this manager, the more I'm impressed with what he's able to do, given the departures, given everything. And I'm just incredibly impressed.
And incredibly impressive it is. They find themselves just 1 point off the top. And yes, you did hear Nico say, can they just pull their shit together? Thierry Henry has been crowned king of football in Nigeria, according to a number of the Red Tops in the UK, which is what makes me think that they've read a parody account. But no, it does seem true after looking a little further into it. And the Mirror writes, the former France international has accumulated an enormous fan base in Nigeria from his glory days with Arsenal. And he's been named Igwe in a fan event in Lagos. Some of the Red Tops claim this makes him, or at some point he was, donned Igwe, which means king of football, on Sunday in front of thousands of adoring fans. It's incredible how people speak about people when they travel. If you could make one person king of football, this is the final question of the podcast, who would you make king of football? Chris,
I think we know your answer.
Well, we obviously know my answer. I think he'd be a gracious, benevolent, omnipotent, and omniscient, God, but king. Nico?
None other than the gentle giant, Yaya Toure.
It's a good shout. I don't know if he'd be the most gracious king, and I don't know if he'd be the most forward-thinking king. But I do like it. Chris?
This is a good question. My mind jumped to Pelé originally, but then given that Mo Salah plays for Faroes, and he is the best, that would be Faroes, wouldn't it? King of football. It's kind of like, who would you want to send up in space, really, isn't it? You have to send one representative of football in
Matt
space.
Ritchie.
Good shout. He does have a magic hat, but sadly it's not a crown. Who would I want to send up? Let's say Johan Cruyff, because I think he's had the greatest influence as player and man.
Chris, that's beautiful and very sweet. That's a lovely way to finish the podcast. Let us know who your football king is. I've got to admit, I do think Romelu Lukaku is somewhat of an aspiring king in it. But yeah, it's definitely a good start. It's been interesting this weekend to cover all the football and then come chat with you guys. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Is there anything you guys think I'm missing from Europe at the moment?
Nothing jumps out to me spectacularly.
Not particularly. I think we've covered the big headlines. But if you want to hear more of us, then you can hear us later in the week. There are going to be some more regular ones over Christmas, or at least you'll get some bonus audio, I think, in that time. It's always lovely to bring the gang together, and we look forward to chatting to you guys over Christmas. If you're getting anyone a brand new iPod or a brand new... Do people still give iPods? Is iPods still a thing? Yeah, I think so. If you're getting a brand new phone, or you're getting a brand new
something... All right,
something,
Mr. iPhone X.
Sure. If you're getting a brand new something, make sure you preload it with a subscription, and that then you show us that subscription. We'd love to see how we're making your holidays better. Because remember, it's all well and good giving an iPhone. It's even better to give an iPhone with a good podcast on it. People just don't know how you're changing their life until it's much, much later. Anyway, Chris, it's been great to have you. Are you going to go shop now in the mall, or are you off somewhere else? Subway?
I'm going to go and see if I can find myself a talk boy.
I think if you go into the Chelsea area, you might be able to... a different thing.
Someone's been here before.
Anyway, Nico, same for you. What are you getting for Christmas?
What am I getting for Christmas? I think a big lump of coal, unfortunately. Been bad this year, so I think probably coal.
Well, fair enough. If you want to let us know what you guys are getting for Christmas, I think we're going to slip one more podcast in before Christmas, and we'll probably cover all of our Christmas content on that. If not, and you can't get enough of your football fill, I would definitely recommend going to listen to the Football Ramble 12 Days of Christmas. There's some great analysis in there. There's some great memories in there. And there's just four genuinely nice guys sitting around talking about football. So go take a look at that. Let us know if you can find us on Twitter at The Front Three. And we'll see you again real soon right here on TF3.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.